Another 40 minutes, down country road after country road, none of them the road he sought. Town began to chew his lower lip. "I'm too old for this shit," he said aloud, relishing the movie star world-weariness of the line. He was pushing 50. Most of his working life had been spent in a branch of government which went only by its initials, and whether or not he had left his government job a dozen years ago for employment by the private sector was open to debate. Some days he thought one way, some days another. Anyway, it was only the Joes on the street that really believed there was a difference. He was on the verge of giving up on the farm when he drove up a hill and saw the sign, hand-painted on the gate. It said simply, as he had been told it would, "Ash." He pulled up the Ford Explorer, climbed out, and untwisted the wire that held the gate closed. He got back in the car and drove through. It was like cooking a frog, he thought. You put the frog in the water, and then you turn on the heat. And by the time the frog notices that there's anything wrong, it's already been cooked. The world in which he worked was all too weird. There was no solid ground beneath his feet. The water in the pot was bubbling fiercely. When he'd been transferred to the agency, it had all seemed so simple. Now it was all so... not complex, he decided, merely bizarre. He had been sitting in Mr. Wirtle's office at 2 that morning, and he had been told what he was to do.
"You got it?"
said Mr. Wirtle, handing him the knife in its dark leather sheath.
"Cut me a stick. It doesn't have to be longer than a couple of feet."
"Affirmative," he said, and then he said, "Why do I have to do this, sir?"
"Because I tell you to," said Mr. Wirtle flatly. "Find the tree, do the job, meet me down in Chattanooga. Don't waste any time."
"And what about the asshole?"
"Shadow? If you see him, just avoid him. Don't touch him. Don't even mess with him. I don't want you turning him into a martyr. There's no room for martyrs in the current game plan."
He smiled then, his scarred smile. Mr. Wirtle was easily amused. Mr. Town had noticed this on several occasions. It had amused him to play chauffeur in Kansas, after all.
"Look, no martyrs, Town."
And Town had nodded, and taken the knife in its sheath, and pushed the rage that welled up inside him down, deep, and away. Mr. Town's hatred of Shadow had become a part of him. As he was falling asleep, he would see Shadow's solemn face, see that smile that wasn't a smile, the way Shadow had of smiling without smiling that made Town want to sink his fist into the man's gut. And even as he fell asleep, he could feel his jaws squeeze together, his temples tense, his gullet burn. He drove the Ford Explorer across the meadow, past an abandoned farmhouse. He crested a ridge and saw the tree. He parked the car a little way past it and turned off the engine. The clock on the dashboard said it was 6:38 a.m. He left the keys in the car and walked toward the tree. The tree was large. It seemed to exist on its own sense of scale. Town couldn't have said if it was 50 feet high or 200. Its bark was the gray of a fine silk scarf. There was a naked man tied to the trunk a little way above the ground by a webwork of ropes, and there was something wrapped in a sheet at the foot of the tree. Town realized what it was as he passed it. He pushed at the sheet with his foot. Wednesday's ruined half a face stared out at him. Town reached the tree. He walked a little way around the thick trunk, away from the sightless eyes of the farmhouse. Then he unzipped his fly and pissed against the trunk of the tree. He did up his fly, he walked back over to the house, found a wooden extension ladder, carried it back to the tree. He leaned it carefully against the trunk, then he climbed up it. Shadow hung limply from the ropes that tied him to the tree. Town wondered if the man were still alive. His chest didn't rise or fall. Dead or almost dead, it didn't matter. "Hello, asshole," Town said aloud. Shadow didn't move. Town reached the top of the ladder, and he pulled out the knife. He found a small branch which seemed to meet Mr. World's specifications, and hacked at the base of it with the knife blade, cutting it half through, then breaking it off with his hand. It was about 30 inches long. He put the knife back in its sheath. Then he started to climb back down the ladder. When he was opposite Shadow, he paused.
"God, I hate you," he said.
He wished he could just have taken out a gun and shot him, and he knew that he couldn't. And then he jabbed the stick in the air toward the hanging man in a stabbing motion. It was an instinctive gesture containing all the frustration and rage inside town. He imagined that he was holding a spear and twisting it into Shadow's guts.
"Come on," he said aloud. "Time to get moving."
Then he thought, first sign of madness, talking to yourself. He climbed down a few more steps, then jumped the rest of the way to the ground. He looked at the stick he was holding, and felt like a small boy, holding his stick as a sword or a spear. "I could have cut a stick from any tree," he thought. "It didn't have to be this tree. Who the fuck would have known?" And he thought, "Mr. World would have known." He carried the ladder back to the farmhouse. From the corner of his eye, he thought he saw something move, and he looked in through the window into the dark room filled with broken furniture, with the plaster peeling from the walls, and for a moment, in a half-dream, he imagined that he saw three women sitting in the dark parlor. One of them was knitting. One of them was staring directly at him. One of them appeared to be asleep. The woman who was staring at him began to smile, a huge smile that seemed to split her face lengthwise, a smile that crossed from ear to ear. Then she raised a finger and touched it to her neck and ran it gently from one side of her neck to the other. That was what he thought he saw, all in a moment in that empty room, which contained, he saw at a second glance, nothing more than old rotting furniture and fly-spotted prints and dry rot. There was nobody there at all. He rubbed his eyes. Town walked back to the brown Ford Explorer and climbed in. He tossed the stick onto the white leather of the passenger seat. He turned the key in the ignition. The dashboard clock said 06:37 a.m. Town frowned and checked his wristwatch, which blinked that it was 13:58. "Great," he thought. "I was either up on that tree for 8 hours or for minus a minute." That was what he thought, but what he believed was that both timepieces had coincidentally begun to misbehave. On the tree, Shadow's body began to bleed. The wound was in his side. The blood that came from it was slow and thick and molasses black. Clouds covered the top of Lookout Mountain. Easter sat some distance away from the crowd at the bottom of the mountain, watching the dawn over the hills to the east. She had a chain of blue forget-me-nots tattooed around her left wrist, and she rubbed them absently with her right thumb. Another night had come and gone, and nothing. The folk were still coming, by ones and twos. The last night had brought several creatures from the southwest, including two small boys, each the size of an apple tree, and something which she had only glimpsed, but which had looked like a disembodied head the size of a VW bug. They had disappeared into the trees at the base of the mountain. Nobody bothered them. Nobody from the outside world even seemed to have noticed they were there. She imagined the tourists at Rock City staring down at them through their insert-a-quarter binoculars, staring straight at a ramshackle encampment of things and people at the foot of the mountain, and seeing nothing but trees and bushes and rocks. She could smell the smoke from a cooking fire, a smell of burning bacon on the chilly dawn wind. Someone at the far end of the encampment began to play the harmonica, which made her involuntarily smile and shiver. She had a paperback book in her backpack, and she waited for the sky to become light enough for her to read. There were two dots in the sky, immediately below the clouds, a small one and a larger one. A spatter of rain brushed her face in the morning wind. A barefoot girl came out from the encampment, walking toward her. She stopped beside a tree, hitched up her skirts, and squatted. When she had finished, Easter hailed her. The girl walked over.
"Good morning, lady," she said. "The battle will start soon now."
The tip of her pink tongue touched her scarlet lips. She had a black crow's wing tied with leather onto her shoulder, a crow's foot on a chain around her neck. Her arms were blue tattooed with lines and patterns and intricate knots.
"How do you know?"
The girl grinned.
"I am Macha of the Morian. When war comes, I can smell it in the air. I am a war goddess, and I say, blood shall be spilled this day."
"Oh," said Easter. "Well, there you go." She was watching the smaller dot in the sky as it tumbled down toward them, dropping like a rock.
"And we shall fight them, and we shall kill them, every one," said the girl. "And we shall take their heads as trophies, and the crows shall have their eyes and their corpses."
The dot had become a bird, its wings outstretched, riding the gusty morning winds above them. Easter cocked her head on one side.
"Is that some hidden war goddess knowledge?" she asked.
"The whole who's going to win thing? Who gets whose head?" "No," said the girl. "I can smell the battle, but that's all. But we'll win. Won't we? We have to. I saw what they did to the All-Father. It's them or us."
"Yeah," said Easter. "I suppose it is."
The girl smiled again, in the half-light, and made her way back to the camp. Easter put her hand down and touched a green shoot which stabbed up from the earth like a knife blade. As she touched it, it grew and opened and twisted and changed until she was resting her hand on a green tulip head. When the sun was high, the flower would open. Easter looked up at the hawk.
"Can I help you?" she said.
The hawk circled about 15 feet above Easter's head slowly, then it glided down to her and landed on the ground nearby. It looked up at her with mad eyes.
"Hello, cutie," she said. "Now, what do you really look like, eh?"
The hawk hopped toward her uncertainly, and then it was no longer a hawk, but a young man. He looked at her and then looked down at the grass.
"You?"
he said. His glance went everywhere, to the grass, to the sky, to the bushes, not to her.
"Me," she said. "What about me?"
"You."
He stopped. He seemed to be trying to muster his thoughts. Strange expressions flitted and swam across his face.
"He spent too long a bird," she thought. "He's forgotten how to be a man."
She waited patiently. Eventually he said,
"Will you come with me?"
"Maybe. Where do you want me to go?"
"The man on the tree, he needs you. A ghost hurt in his side. The blood came, then it stopped. I think he's dead."
"There's a war on. I can't just go running away."
The naked man said nothing, just moved from one foot to another as if he were uncertain of his weight, as if he were used to resting on the air or on a swaying branch, not on the solid earth. Then he said,
"If he is gone forever, it is all over."
"But the battle..."
"If he is lost, it will not matter who wins."
He looked like he needed a blanket and a cup of sweet coffee, and someone to take him somewhere he could just shiver and babble until he got his mind back. He held his arms stiffly against his sides.
"Where is this? Nearby?"
He stared at the tulip plant and shook his head.
"Way away."
"Well," she said, "I'm needed here, and I can't just leave. How do you expect me to get there? I can't fly like you, you know."
"No," said Horus, "you can't."
Then he looked up gravely and pointed to the other dot that circled them as it dropped from the darkening clouds, growing in size.
"He can."
Another several hours, pointless driving, and by now, Town hated the global positioning system almost as much as he hated Shadow. There was no passion in the hate, though. He had thought finding his way to the farm, to the great silver ash tree, had been hard. Finding his way away from the farm was much harder. It didn't seem to matter which road he took, which direction he drove down the narrow country lanes, the twisting Virginia back roads, which must have begun, he was sure, as deer trails and cow paths. Eventually he would find himself passing the farm once more and the hand-painted sign, Ash. This was crazy, wasn't it? He simply had to retrace his way, take a left turn for every right he had taken on his way here, a right turn for every left. Only that was what he had done last time, and now here he was back at the farm once more. There were heavy storm clouds coming in. It was getting dark fast. It felt like night, not morning, and he had a long drive ahead of him. He would never get to Chattanooga before afternoon at this rate. His cell phone gave him only a no-service message. The fold-out map in the car's glove compartments showed the main roads, all the interstates and the real highways, but as far as it was concerned, nothing else existed. Nor was there anyone around that he could ask. The houses were set back from the roads. There were no welcoming lights. Now the fuel gauge was nudging empty. He heard a rumble of distant thunder, and a single drop of rain splashed heavily onto his windshield. So, when Town saw the woman walking along the side of the road, he found himself smiling involuntarily. "Thank God," he said aloud, and he drew up beside her. He thumbed down her window. "Ma'am, I'm sorry, I'm kind of lost. Can you tell me how to get to Highway 81 from here?" She looked at him through the open passenger side window and said, "You know, I don't think I can explain it, but I can show you if you like." She was pale, and her wet hair was long and dark. "Climb in," said Town. He didn't even hesitate. "First thing, we need to buy some gas."
"Thanks," she said. "I needed a ride."
She got in. Her eyes were astonishingly blue.
"There's a stick here on the seat," she said, puzzled.
"Just throw it in the back. Where are you heading?" he asked. "Lady, if you can get me to a gas station and back to a freeway, I'll take you all the way to your own front door."
She said, "Thank you, but I think I'm going farther than you are. If you can get me to the freeway, that'll be fine. Maybe a trucker will give me a ride."
And she smiled, a crooked, determined smile. It was the smile that did it. "Ma'am," he said, "I can give you a finer ride than any trucker." He could smell her perfume. It was heady and heavy, a cloying scent like magnolias or lilacs, but he didn't mind.
"I'm going to Georgia," she said. "It's a long way."
"I'm going to Chattanooga. I'll take you as far as I can."
"Hmm," she said. "What's your name?"
"They call me Mac," said Mr. Town. When he was talking to women in bars, he would sometimes follow that up with, "And the ones that know me really well call me Big Mac." That could wait. With a long drive ahead of them, they would have many hours in each other's company to get to know each other. "What's yours?"
"Laura," she told him.
"Well, Laura," he said, "I'm sure we're going to be great friends." The fat kid found Mr. World in the Rainbow Room, a walled section of the path, its window glass covered in clear plastic sheets of green and red and yellow film. He was walking impatiently from window to window, staring out in turn at a golden world, a red world, a green world. His hair was reddish-orange and close-cropped to his skull. He wore a Burberry raincoat. The fat kid coughed. Mr. World looked up.
"Excuse me, Mr. World?"
"Yes. Is everything on schedule?"
The fat kid's mouth was dry. He licked his lips and said,
"I've set up everything. I don't have confirmation on the choppers."
"The helicopters will be here when we need them."
"Good," said the fat kid. "Good."
He stood there, not saying anything, not going away. There was a bruise on his forehead. After a while, Mr. World said,
Is there anything else I can do for you?
A pause. The boy swallowed and nodded.
Something else, he said. Yes.
Would you feel more comfortable discussing it in private?
The boy nodded again. Mr. World walked with the kid back to his operations center, a damp cave containing a diorama of drunken pixies making moonshine with a still. A sign outside warned tourists away during renovations. The two men sat down on plastic chairs.
How can I help you?
Asked Mr. World.
Yes. Okay. Right. Two things. Okay. One, what are we waiting for? And two is harder. Look, we have the guns, right? We have the firepower. They have fucking swords and knives and fucking hammers and stone axes and, like, tire irons. We have fucking smart bombs.
Which we will not be using,
pointed out the other man.
I know that. You said that already. I know that. And that's doable. But, look, ever since I did the job on that bitch in L.A., I've been...
He stopped, made a face, seemed unwilling to go on.
You've been troubled?
Yes. Good word. Troubled, yes. Like a home for troubled teens. Funny. Yes.
And what exactly is troubling you?
Well, we fight, we win.
And that is a source of trouble? I find it a matter of triumph and delight myself.
But they'll die out anyway. They are passenger pigeons and thylacines. Yes? Who cares? This way it's going to be a bloodbath.
Ah, Mr. World nodded. He was following. That was good. The fat kid said,
Look, I'm not the only one who feels this way. I've checked with the crew at Radio Modern, and they're all for settling this peacefully, and the intangibles are pretty much in favor of letting market forces take care of it. I'm being, you know, the voice of reason here.
You are indeed. Unfortunately, there is information you do not have.
The smile that followed was twisted and scarred. The boy blinked. He said,
Mr. World, what happened to your lips?
World sighed.
The truth of the matter, he said, is that somebody once sewed them together a long time ago.
Whoa, said the fat kid. Serious omerta shit.
Yes. You want to know what we're waiting for? Why we didn't strike last night?
The fat kid nodded. He was sweating, but it was a cold sweat.
We didn't strike yet, because I'm waiting for a stick.
A stick?
That's right, a stick. And do you know what I'm going to do with the stick?
A head shake.
Okay, I'll bite. What?
I could tell you, said Mr. World soberly, but then I'd have to kill you.
He winked, and the tension in the room evaporated. The fat kid began to giggle, a low, snuffling laugh in the back of his throat and in his nose.
Okay, he said. Okay, got it. Message received on Planet Technical, loud and clear. Ixnay on the Estion's Quay.
Mr. World shook his head. He rested a hand on the fat kid's shoulder.
Hey, he said, you really want to know?
Sure.
Well, said Mr. World, seeing that we're friends, here's the answer. I'm going to take the stick, and I'm going to throw it over the armies as they come together. As I throw it, it'll become a spear, and then as the spear arcs over the battle, I'm going to shout, I dedicate this battle to Odin.
Huh? Said the fat kid. Why?
Power, said Mr. World.
He scratched his chin.
And food. A combination of the two. You see, the outcome of the battle is unimportant. What matters is the chaos and the slaughter.
I don't get.
Let me show you. It'll be just like this, said Mr. World. Watch.
He took the wooden-bladed hunter's knife from the pocket of his Burberry, and in one fluid movement he slipped the blade of it into the soft flesh beneath the fat kid's chin and pushed hard upward toward the brain.
"I dedicate this death to Odin," he said, as the knife sank in.
There was a leakage onto his hand of something that was not actually blood, and a sputtering, sparking noise behind the fat kid's eyes. The smell on the air was that of burning insulation wire. The fat kid's hand twitched spastically, and then he fell. The expression on his face was one of puzzlement and misery.
"Look at him," said Mr. World, conversationally, to the air. "He looks as if he just saw a sequence of zeros and ones turn into a flock of brightly colored birds and fly away."
There was no reply from the empty rock corridor. Mr. World shouldered the body as if it weighed very little, and he opened the pixie diorama and dropped the body beside the still, covering it with its long black raincoat. He would dispose of it that evening, he decided. And he grinned his scarred grin. Hiding a body on a battlefield would almost be too easy. Nobody would ever notice. Nobody would care. For a little while there was silence in that place. And then a gruff voice, which was not Mr. World's, cleared its throat in the shadows and said,
"Good start."
Chapter 18. They tried to stand off the soldiers, but the men fired and killed them both. So the song's wrong about the jail, but that's put in for poetry. You can't always have things like they are in poetry. Poetry ain't what you'd call truth. There ain't room enough in the verses. The singer's commentary on The Ballad of Sam Bass in A Treasury of American Folklore. None of this can actually be happening. If it makes you more comfortable, you could simply think of it as metaphor. Religions are, by definition, metaphors, after all. God is a dream, a hope, a woman, an ironist, a father, a city, a house of many rooms, a watchmaker who left his prize chronometer in the desert, someone who loves you, even perhaps against all evidence, a celestial being whose only interest is to make sure your football team, army, business, or marriage thrives, prospers, and triumphs over all opposition. Religions are places to stand and look and act, vantage points from which to view the world. So, none of this is happening. Such things could not occur. Never a word of it is literally true. Even so, the next thing that happened, happened like this. At the foot of Lookout Mountain, men and women were gathered around a small bonfire in the rain. They were standing beneath the trees, which provided poor cover, and they were arguing. The Lady Kali, with her ink-black skin and her white, sharp teeth, said, "It is time." Anansi, with lemon-yellow gloves and silvering hair, shook his head. "We can wait," he said. "While we can wait, we should wait." There was a murmur of disagreement from the crowd.
"No, listen. He's right,"
said an old man with iron-gray hair, Chernobok. He was holding a small sledgehammer, resting the head of it on his shoulder.
"They have the high ground. The weather is against us. This is madness to begin this now."
Something that looked a little like a wolf and a little more like a man grunted and spat on the forest floor.
"When better to attack them, Dyedushka? Shall we wait until the weather clears when they expect it? I say we go now. I say we move." "There are clouds between us and them," pointed out Isten of the Hungarians.
He had a fine black mustache, a large dusty black hat, and the grin of a man who makes his living selling aluminum siding and new roofs and gutters to senior citizens, but who always leaves town the day after the checks clear, whether the work is done or not. A man in an elegant suit, who had until now said nothing, put his hands together, stepped into the firelight, and made his point succinctly and clearly. There were nods and mutters of agreement. A voice came from one of three warrior women who comprised the Morion, standing so close together in the shadows that they had become an arrangement of blue-tattooed limbs and dangling crow's wings. She said, "It doesn't matter whether this is a good time or a bad time. This is the time. They have been killing us. Better to die together on the attack like gods than to die fleeing and singly like rats in a cellar." Another murmur, this time one of deep agreement. She had said it for all of them. Now was the time.
"The first head is mine," said a very tall Chinese man with a rope of tiny skulls around his neck.
He began to walk slowly and intently up the mountain, shouldering a staff with a curved blade at the end of it, like a silver moon. Even nothing cannot last forever. He might have been there, been nowhere, for 10 minutes or for 10,000 years, it made no difference. Time was an idea for which he no longer had any need. He could no longer remember his real name. He felt empty and cleansed in that place that was not a place. He was without form and void. He was nothing. And into that nothing, a voice said, "Ohoka, cousin, we got to talk." And something that might once have been Shadow said, "Whiskey Jack?"
"Yeah," said Whiskey Jack in the darkness. "You are a hard man to hunt down when you're dead. You didn't go to any of the places I figured. I had to look all over before I thought of checking here. Say, you ever find your tribe?"
Shadow remembered the man and the girl in the disco beneath the spinning mirror ball.
"I guess I found my family.
But no, I never found my tribe.
Sorry to have to disturb you."
"Let me be. I got what I wanted. I'm done."
"They are coming for you," said Whiskey Jack. "They are going to revive you."
"But I'm done," said Shadow. "It was all over and done."
"No such thing," said Whiskey Jack. "Never any such thing. We'll go to my place. You want a beer?"
He guessed he would like a beer at that.
"Sure." "Get me one, too. There's a cooler outside the door," said Whiskey Jack, and he pointed. They were in his shack.
Shadow opened the door to the shack with hands he had not possessed moments before. There was a plastic cooler filled with chunks of river ice out there, and in the ice, a dozen cans of Budweiser. He pulled out a couple of cans of beer, and then sat in the doorway and looked out over the valley. They were at the top of a hill, near a waterfall, swollen with melting snow and runoff. It fell, in stages, maybe 70 feet below them, maybe 100. The sun reflected from the ice which sheathed the trees that overhung the waterfall basin.
"Where are we?" asked Shadow.
"Where you were last time," said Whiskey Jack. "My place. You planning on holding onto my butt till it warms up?"
Shadow stood up and passed him the can of beer. "You didn't have a waterfall outside your place last time I was here," he said. Whiskey Jack said nothing. He popped the top of the bud and drank half the can in one long, slow swallow. Then he said,
"You remember my nephew, Henry Bluejay, the poet? He traded his Buick for your Winnebago, remember?"
"Sure. I didn't know he was a poet."
Whiskey Jack raised his chin and looked proud. "Best damn poet in America," he said.
He drained the rest of his can of beer, belched, and got another can, while Shadow popped open his own can of beer, and the two men sat outside on a rock by the pale green ferns in the morning sun, and they watched the falling water, and they drank their beer. There was still snow on the ground, in the places where the shadows never lifted. The earth was muddy and wet.
"Henry was diabetic," continued Whiskey Jack. "It happens. Too much. You people came to America, you take our sugar cane, potatoes, and corn, then you sell us potato chips and caramel popcorn. And we're the ones who get sick."
He sipped his beer, reflecting.
"He'd won a couple of prizes for his poetry. There were people in Minnesota who wanted to put his poems into a book. He was driving to Minnesota in a sports car to talk to them. He had traded your bagel for a yellow Miata. The doctors said they think he went into a coma while he was driving, went off the road, ran the car into one of your road signs. Too lazy to look at where you are, to read the mountains and the clouds. You people need road signs everywhere. And so Henry Bluejay went away forever. Went to live with Brother Wolf. So I said, nothing keeping me there any longer. I came north. Good fishing up here."
"I'm sorry about your nephew."
"Me too. So now I'm living here in the north, long way from white man's diseases, white man's roads, white man's road signs, white man's yellow Miatas, white man's caramel popcorn."
"White man's beer?" Whiskey Jack looked at the can.
"When you people finally give up and go home, you can leave us the Budweiser breweries," he said.
"Where are we?" asked Shadow. "Am I on the tree? Am I dead? Am I here? I thought everything was finished. What's real?"
"Yes," said Whiskey Jack.
"Yes? What kind of an answer is yes?"
"It's a good answer. True answer, too."
Shadow said, "Are you a god as well?" Whiskey Jack shook his head.
"I'm a culture hero," he said. "We do the same shit gods do. We just screw up more, and nobody worships us. They tell stories about us, but they tell the ones which make us look bad, along with the ones where we came out fairly okay."
"I see," said Shadow. And he did see, more or less.
"Look," said Whiskey Jack, "this is not a good country for gods. My people figured that out early on. There are creator spirits who found the earth, or made it, or shit it out. But you think about it, who's going to worship Coyote? He made love to Porcupine Woman and got his dick shot through with more needles than a pincushion. He'd argue with rocks, and the rocks would win. So, yeah, my people figured that maybe there's something at the back of it all, a creator, a great spirit. And so we say thank you to it, because it's always good to say thank you. But we never built churches. We didn't need to. The land was the church. The land was the religion. The land was older and wiser than the people who walked on it. It gave us salmon and corn and buffalo and passenger pigeons. It gave us wild rice and walleye. It gave us melon and squash and turkey, and we were the children of the land, just like the porcupine and the skunk and the blue jay."
He finished his second beer and gestured toward the river at the bottom of the waterfall.
"You follow that river for a way, you'll get to the lakes where the wild rice grows. In wild rice time, you go out in your canoe with a friend, and you knock the wild rice into your canoe and cook it and store it, and it'll keep you for a long time. Different places grow different foods. Go far enough south, there are orange trees, lemon trees, and those squashy green guys look like pears.
Avocados."
"Avocados," agreed Whiskey Jack. "That's them. They don't grow up this way. This is wild rice country, moose country. What I'm trying to say is that America is like that. It's not good growing country for gods. They don't grow well here. They're like avocados trying to grow in wild rice country."
"They may not grow well," said Shadow, remembering, "but they're going to war." That was the only time he ever saw Whiskey Jack laugh. It was almost a bark, and it had little humor in it.
"Hey, Shadow," said Whiskey Jack, If all your friends jumped off a cliff, would you jump off too?
Maybe. Shadow felt good. He didn't think it was just the beer. He couldn't remember the last time he had felt so alive and so together.
It's not going to be a war.
Then what is it?
Whiskey Jack crushed the beer can between his hands, pressing it until it was flat.
Look, he said, and pointed to the waterfall.
The sun was high enough that it caught the waterfall spray. A rainbow nimbus hung in the air. Shadow thought it was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen.
It's going to be a bloodbath, said Whiskey Jack flatly.
Shadow saw it then. He saw it all, stark in its simplicity. He shook his head. Then he began to chuckle, and he shook his head some more, and the chuckle became a full-throated laugh.
You okay?
I'm fine, said Shadow.
I just saw the hidden Indians. Not all of them, but I saw them anyhow. Probably a Ho-Chunk, then. Those guys never could hide worth a damn.
He looked up at the sun.
Time to go back, he said. He stood up.
It's a two-man con, said Shadow.
It's not a war at all, is it?
Whiskey Jack patted Shadow's arm.
You're not so dumb, he said.
They walked back to Whiskey Jack's shack. He opened the door. Shadow hesitated.
I wish I could stay here with you, he said. This seems like a good place.
There are a lot of good places, said Whiskey Jack. That's kind of the point. Listen, gods die when they are forgotten. People too. But the land's still here. The good places and the bad. The land isn't going anywhere. And neither am I.
Shadow closed the door. Something was pulling at him. He was alone in the darkness once more, but the darkness became brighter and brighter until it was burning like the sun. And then the pain began. Easter walked through the meadow, and spring flowers blossomed where she had passed. She walked by a place where, long ago, a farmhouse had stood. Even today, several walls were still standing, jutting out of the weeds and the meadow grass like rotten teeth. A thin rain was falling. The clouds were dark and low, and it was cold. A little way beyond the place where the farmhouse had been, there was a tree, a huge silver-gray tree, winter dead to all appearances, and leafless. And in front of the tree, on the grass, were frayed clumps of colorless fabric. The woman stopped at the fabric and bent down, and picked up something brownish-white. It was a much-gnawed fragment of bone which might once have been a part of a human skull. She tossed it back down onto the grass. Then she looked at the man on the tree, and she smiled wryly.
"They just aren't as interesting naked," she said. "It's the unwrapping that's half the fun, like with gifts and eggs."
The hawk-headed man who walked beside her looked down at his penis and seemed, for the first time, to become aware of his own nakedness. He said,
"I can look at the sun without even blinking."
"That's very clever of you," Easter told him, reassuringly. "Now let's get him down from there."
The wet ropes that held Shadow to the tree had long ago weathered and rotted, and they parted easily as the two people pulled on them. The body on the tree slipped and slid down toward the roots. They caught him as he fell, and they took him up, carrying him easily, although he was a very big man, and they put him down in the gray meadow. The body on the grass was cold, and it didn't breathe. There was a patch of dried black blood on its side, as if it had been stabbed with a spear.
"What now?"
"Now," she said, "we warm him. You know what you have to do."
"I know. I cannot,"
If you are not willing to help, then you should not have called me here. She reached out a white hand to Horace, and she touched his black hair. He blinked at her intently. Then he shimmered as if in a heat haze. The hawk eye that faced her glinted orange, as if a flame had just been kindled inside it, a flame that had been long extinguished. The hawk took to the air, and it swung upward, circling and ascending in a rising gyre, circling the place in the gray clouds where the sun might conceivably be, and as the hawk rose, it became first a dot, and then a speck, and then, to the naked eye, nothing at all, something that could only be imagined. The clouds began to thin and to evaporate, creating a patch of blue sky through which the sun glared. The single bright sunbeam penetrating the clouds and bathing the meadow was beautiful, but the image faded as more clouds vanished. Soon the morning sun was blazing down on that meadow like a summer sun at noon, burning the water vapor from the morning's rain into mists, and burning the mist off into nothing at all. The golden sun bathed the body and the floor of the meadow with its radiance and its heat. Shades of pink and of warm brown touched the dead thing. The woman dragged the fingers of her right hand lightly across the body's chest. She imagined she could feel a shiver in his breast, something that was not a heartbeat, but still. She let her hand remain there, on his chest, just above his heart. She lowered her lips to Shadow's lips, and she breathed into his lungs, a gentle in and out. And then the breath became a kiss. Her kiss was gentle, and it tasted of spring rains and meadow flowers. The wound in his side began to flow with liquid blood once more, a scarlet blood which oozed like liquid rubies in the sunlight, and then the bleeding stopped. She kissed his cheek and his forehead. "Come on," she said. "Time to get up. It's all happening. You don't want to miss it." His eyes fluttered, and then they opened. Two eyes, the gray of evening. And he looked at her. She smiled, and then she removed her hand from his chest. He said, "You called me back." He said it slowly, as if he had forgotten how to speak English. There was hurt in his voice, and puzzlement. "Yes. I was done. I was judged. It was over. You called me back. You dared."
"I'm sorry."
"Yes." He sat up slowly. He winced and touched his side. Then he looked puzzled. There was a beading of wet blood there, but there was no wound beneath it. He reached out a hand, and she put her arm around him and helped him to his feet. He looked across the meadow as if he was trying to remember the names of the things he was looking at, the flowers in the long grass, the ruins of the farmhouse, the haze of green buds that fogged the branches of the huge silver tree.
"Do you remember?" she asked.
"Do you remember what you learned?"
"I lost my name. And I lost my heart. And you brought me back."
"I'm sorry," she said. "They are going to fight soon. The old gods and the new ones."
"You want me to fight for you? You wasted your time."
"I brought you back because that was what I had to do," she said. "What you do now is whatever you have to do. Your call. I did my part."
Suddenly, she became aware of his nakedness, and she blushed, a burning scarlet flush, and she looked down and away. In the rain and the cloud, shadows moved up the side of the mountain, up to the rock pathways. White foxes padded up the hill in company with red-haired men in green jackets. There was a bull-headed minotaur walking beside an iron-fingered dactyl. A pig, a monkey, and a sharp-toothed ghoul clambered up the hillside in company with a blue-skinned man holding a flaming bow, a bear with flowers twined into its fur, and a man in golden chainmail holding his sword of eyes. Beautiful Antinous, who was the lover of Hadrian, walked up the hillside at the head of a company of leather queens, their arms and chests steroids sculpted into perfect shapes. A gray-skinned man, his one cyclopean eye a huge cabochon emerald, walked stiffly up the hill ahead of several squat and swarthy men, their impassive faces as regular as Aztec carvings. They knew the secrets that the jungles had swallowed. A sniper at the top of the hill took careful aim at a white fox and fired. There was an explosion and a puff of cordite, gunpowder scent on the wet air. The corpse was a young Japanese woman with her stomach blown away and her face all bloody. Slowly the corpse began to fade. The people continued up the hill, on two legs, on four legs, on no legs at all. The drive through the Tennessee mountain country had been startlingly beautiful whenever the storm had eased, and nerve-wracking whenever the rain had pelted down. Town and Laura had talked and talked and talked the whole way. He was so glad he had met her. It was like meeting an old friend, a really good old friend you'd simply never met before. They talked history and movies and music, and she turned out to be the only person, the only other person he had ever met, who had seen a foreign film. Mr. Town was sure it was Spanish, while Laura was just as certain it was Polish. From the 60s, called The Manuscript Found in Saragossa, a film he had been starting to believe he had hallucinated. When Laura pointed out the first Sea Rock City barn to him, he chuckled and admitted that that was where he was headed. She said that was so cool. She always wanted to visit those kinds of places, but she never made the time and always regretted it later. That was why she was on the road right now. She was having an adventure. She was a travel agent, she told him, separated from her husband. She admitted that she didn't think they could ever get back together and said it was her fault. I can't believe that, she sighed.
It's true, Mac. I'm just not the woman he married anymore.
Well, he told her, people change. And before he could think, he was telling her everything he could tell her about his life. He was even telling her about Woody and Stoner, how the three of them were the Three Musketeers, and the two of them were killed. You think you'd get hardened to that kind of thing in government work, but you never did. And she reached out one hand. It was cold enough that he turned up the car's heating and squeezed his hand tightly in hers. Lunchtime, they ate bad Japanese food, while a thunderstorm lowered on Knoxville, and Town didn't care that the food was late, that the miso soup was cold, or that the sushi was warm. He loved the fact that she was out, with him, having an adventure.
"Well," confided Laura, "I hated the idea of getting stale. I was just rotting away where I was. So I set off without my car and without my credit cards. I'm just relying on the kindness of strangers."
"Aren't you scared?" he asked. "I mean, you could be stranded, you could be mugged, you could starve."
She shook her head. Then she said with a hesitant smile, "I met you, didn't I?"
And he couldn't find anything to say.
When the meal was over, they ran through the storm to his car, holding Japanese-language newspapers to cover their heads, and they laughed as they ran, like schoolchildren in the rain.
"How far can I take you?" he asked, when they made it back into the car.
"I'll go as far as you're going, Mac," she told him shyly.
He was glad he hadn't used the Big Mac line. This woman wasn't a barroom one-nighter. Mr. Town knew that in his soul. It might have taken him 50 years to find her, but this was finally it. This was the one. This wild, magical woman with the long dark hair. This was love.
"Look," he said, as they approached Chattanooga. The wipers sloshed the rain across the windshield, blurring the gray of the city.
"How about I find a motel for you tonight?
I'll pay for it. And once I make my delivery, we can, well, we can take a hot bath together for a start. Warm you up.
That sounds wonderful, said Laura. What are you delivering?
That stick, he told her, and chuckled. The one on the back seat.
Okay, she said, humoring him. Then don't tell me, Mr. Mysterious.
He told her it would be best if she waited in the car in the Rock City parking lot while he made his delivery. He drove up the side of Lookout Mountain in the driving rain, never breaking 30 miles per hour, with his headlights burning. They parked at the back of the parking lot. He turned off the engine.
Hey, Mac. Before you get out of the car, don't I get a hug?
Asked Laura with a smile. You surely do, said Mr. Town, and he put his arms around her, and she snuggled close to him while the rain pattered a tattoo on the roof of the Ford Explorer. He could smell her hair. There was a faintly unpleasant scent beneath the smell of the perfume. Travel would do it every time. That bath, he decided, was a real must for both of them. He wondered if there was any place in Chattanooga where he could get those lavender bath bombs his first wife had loved so much. Laura raised her head against his, and her hand stroked the line of his neck absently.
Mac, I keep thinking. You must really want to know what happened to those friends of yours, she asked. Woody and Stone. Do you?
Yeah, he said, moving his lips down to hers for the first kiss. Sure I do.
So, she showed him.
Shadow walked the meadow, making his own slow circles around the trunk of the tree, gradually widening his circle. Sometimes he would stop and pick something up, a flower, or a leaf, or a pebble, or a twig, or a blade of grass. He would examine it minutely, as if concentrating entirely on the twigness of the twig, the leafness of the leaf. Easter found herself reminded of the gaze of a baby at the point where it learns to focus. She did not dare to talk to him. At that moment, it would have been sacrilegious. She watched him, exhausted as she was, and she wondered. About 20 feet out from the base of the tree, half overgrown with long meadow grass and dead creepers, he found a canvas bag. Shadow picked it up, untied the knots at the top of the bag, loosened the drawstring. The clothes he pulled out were his own. They were old, but still serviceable. He turned the shoes over in his hands. He stroked the fabric of the shirt, the wool of the sweater, stared at them as if he were looking at them across a million years. One by one, he put them on. He put his hands into his pockets and looked puzzled as he pulled one hand out, holding what looked to Easter like a white and gray marble. He said, "No coins." It was the first thing he had said in several hours.
"No coins?" echoed Easter.
He shook his head. "They gave me something to do with my hands." He bent down to pull on his shoes. Once he was dressed, he looked more normal. Grave, though. She wondered how far he had traveled and what it had cost him to return. He was not the first whose return she had initiated, and she knew that, soon enough, the million-year stare would fade, and the memories and the dreams that he had brought back from the tree would be elided by the world of things you could touch. That was the way it always went. She led their way to the rear of the meadow. Her mount waited in the trees.
"It can't carry both of us," she told him. "I'll make my own way home."
Shadow nodded. He seemed to be trying to remember something. Then he opened his mouth, and he screeched, a cry of welcome and of joy. The Thunderbird opened its cruel beak, and it screeched a welcome back at him. Superficially, at least, it resembled a condor. Its feathers were black with a purplish sheen, and its neck was banded with white.
Its beak was black and cruel, a raptor's beak, made for tearing. At rest, on the ground, with its wings folded away, it was the size of a black bear, and its head was on a level with Shadow's own. Aurus said proudly,
"I brought him. They live in the mountains."
Shadow nodded. "I had a dream of thunderbirds once," he said. "Damnedest dream I ever had." The thunderbird opened its beak and made a surprisingly gentle noise. "Crow-roo." "You heard my dream, too?" asked Shadow. He reached out a hand and rubbed it gently against the bird's head.